violation of TOIA being arrested.
Mm-hmm. I think that it
from Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This was a fairly tense affair. Nobody knew what was going to happen yesterday. I mean, technically, I could be in jail, too. I presented myself as a defendant. And under Turkish law, they are actually required to pursue that.
A court in Istanbul acquits a Turkish publisher who has published the work of Noam Chomsky. We speak with Chomsky in Istanbul. He's on his way to Kurdistan.
How are you getting to Kurdistan?
There was a question as to whether it would be... I actually, to tell you the honest truth, I don't want to talk too much. Everything's monitored.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll work out.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has given the CIA the initial go-ahead to begin covert operations to oust Iraq's Saddam Hussein. The plan calls for a steadily escalating operation, beginning with sabotage, psychological warfare, and support for Iraqi opposition groups. Eventually, it could even involve inserting CIA and Special Forces hit teams into the country to direct massive air assaults against the country. This, according to the New York Post, as well as other newspapers. The plan, conceived by the CIA chief, George Tenet, is based on the strategy used in Afghanistan that relies heavily on U.S. air power, cluster bombs, special forces, and opposition fighters. Intelligence sources said CIA operatives are already expanding contacts and activities with three main Iraqi opposition groups. The Iraqi opposition groups are the Iraqi National Congress, the Kurds in northern Iraq, and Shiite Muslims in the south. The U.S. is expected to intensify the pressure on Iraq in May with a scheduled showdown at the U.N. Security Council over demands that Iraq readmit inspectors looking for weapons of mass destruction. Iraq's refusal to comply could not only result in new sanctions, but also be used by the Bush administration as an excuse to begin widespread multilateral military action. The U.S. has been bombing Iraq regularly since the Gulf War. The U.S. also says it's willing to go this strategy alone. And then this news from Salt Lake City as the country gathers in front of the TV night after night to watch the Utah 2002 Winter Olympics. Others are gathering outside Utah's Olympic Park to demonstrate to the world that not all people from Utah are thrilled about the corporate games. The protesters range from animal rights groups demonstrating against the Olympic rodeo to welfare rights groups who demand that the millions of taxpayer dollars spent on the Olympics should go to education and community needs. Last night, the Citizen Action Network, a network of activist groups based in Salt Lake City, held a major march and rally against the corporate profiteering and patriotic cheerleading of the Olympic Games. Gina Edvilson of KRCL in Salt Lake City put together some of the sounds of people she's interviewed, speeches from teach-ins, and the sounds of the protests in the streets.
The Olympics have been in the planning stages for 10 years. The First Amendment's been around for more than 200 years. It seems to me that when you were setting up the Olympics and saying the Olympics are essentially going to take over downtown Salt Lake City for 2.5 weeks, that there should have been a plan in place early on to accommodate the First Amendment.
They would rather be on the 6 o'clock news, but the 6 o'clock news won't happen. So instead, they're going to come when the cameras are rolling, where there's a lot of attention, and they're going to do what they need to get their message out. And these are people who are very dedicated, believe very strongly what they'll do. They'll risk arrest, they'll risk injury. I imagine some of them probably would risk their lives.
We know that tonight, as people begin to watch bobsledding and skiing, we know that tonight in Salt Lake City, people will have no place to lay their head.
We, from the beginning, plan to have a protest right here, right across from the Metals Plaza. We want to call attention to the fact that hundreds of millions of public dollars are being spent on the Olympics when there's all kinds of unmet social needs. You know, for example, there's a banner right here, almost 300,000 Utahns without health insurance. Social services are being cut back, and a huge amount of public money is going on the Olympics. So we question the priorities for this event, which is basically, it's a corporate-dominated event where major corporations are making big bucks. NBC expects to make at least $75 million. And we're subsidizing, the public is subsidizing this basically corporate-controlled entertainment event. You know, we want people to think about those priorities.
The major corporations are making big money off of these games, while the people who live in Salt Lake City are not getting the benefit. We're not getting the jobs, we're not getting the, you know, the insurance, anything. We're not getting a big cash flow back from these games the way that, you know, Coca-Cola, Visa, Nike are branding the athletes.
We tried checking out all the temporary services, you know, around here, you know, and we can't even get work, to be honest with you. And it's because of the Olympics. So there you go.
My name is Wang Po. I'm coming from Switzerland, and I'm speaking here today on behalf of a worldwide coalition of Tibetan groups. What we demand is quite simple. It's the IOC should find a new venue for 2008.
Human rights continues to suffer, and we would like to ask for support.
Here, folks, about the corporate games, corporate sponsorship. What we want here is we want the corporations out of the Olympics. We want Olympic truth. Why is the United States?
I believe that there's going to be many thousands of people coming to Salt Lake to protest.
Those were the sounds of the streets and the teach-ins and interviews that were done by Gina Edvilson of KRCL in Salt Lake City, recorded by her following yesterday's major march and rally against the corporate games, the Utah Olympics 2002. And finally, today is Valentine's Day, the national hallmark holiday of love, hearts, roses, and chocolate. Lots of chocolate. Milk chocolate, dark chocolate, caramel-filled chocolate, chocolate hearts, chocolate kisses. Well, recent investigations have uncovered that a reemergence of child slavery and oppressive labor conditions very much describe where that chocolate comes from, especially in the cocoa fields of the Ivory Coast, the country that supplies more of the world's cocoa beans than anywhere else. Some 15,000 children have been sold into forced labor on cotton, coffee, and cocoa plantations in the Ivory Coast in the past few years. Most are between the ages of 12 and 16, some as young as 9. Well, today, people across the United States are holding rallies to raise awareness about the conditions of the cocoa fields and to call on one particular company, Sees Inc., one of the largest Valentine's Day retailers, to take immediate steps to end child slavery. We go now to San Francisco to Deborah James, who is the Fair Trade Director for Global Exchange. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the chocolate and about Sees Inc. in particular?
Yes. Well, we have been sort of disgusted to learn about these labor conditions, to actually see the emergence of child slavery happen in an industry that is supposed to be about sweets. And this Valentine's Day, it's really up to us, the consumers, to let the big chocolate companies know that we demand products that match our desire for freedom and fairness for ourselves as much as the young African slaves who produce the chocolate. So we're organizing demonstrations in 31 cities across the country, as well as rallies in cities where there aren't these candies, to call on them to carry fair trade chocolate. We're calling on them if people want to call in to seize candies. They actually have a 1-800 customer service number. It's 1-800-347-7337. That's 347-7337. Seize is saying that because they don't actually make the chocolate, that they're not responsible. And we say that since they're reaping profits from low cocoa prices, buying the chocolate from another company, it doesn't matter. These corporations are benefiting from child slavery and unjust labor conditions.
Deborah James, thanks for being with us of Global Exchange. You are listening to Democracy Now! Baby, we've got a date. The Wailers, Catch a Fire, here on Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to spend the hour today looking at Turkey, where a court in Istanbul has just acquitted a Turkish publisher who'd been accused of producing propaganda against the unity of the Turkish state. The charges against Fatih Tas stem from his publishing of a book of essays and speeches that include those of MIT professor Noam Chomsky. In its indictment against Tas, the Turkish prosecutor cited statements and writings by Chomsky which detail the massive support the regime receives from Washington in its violent campaign against the country's Kurdish minority. By some estimates, this campaign has resulted in the deaths of some 50,000 Kurds. In one essay in the book, Chomsky describes the U.S.-backed assault against the Kurds as intensive ethnic cleansing. The Turkish government also listed Chomsky among the accused. Well, despite the charges, Chomsky traveled to Istanbul to stand with Fatih Tas in court on Wednesday. After his acquittal, Tas credited Chomsky with aiding in his release. He could have faced a year in prison simply for publishing the book. Well, early this morning, I caught up with Noam Chomsky by surprise. I reached him about 4 o'clock in the morning, his time, Istanbul time, right before he left for Kurdistan, and asked him to describe why he is in Turkey.
Okay. Well, I'm here in Istanbul. I came primarily because of the trial of a publisher who published a collection of essays of mine. One of them was a talk, a transcript of a talk on the Middle East that I gave in a university in the United States. Like everything I write, it was about the United States. I talked, and in the course of it, I talked about U.S. relations with Turkey, of course. And in particular, I talked about the massive U.S. contribution, particularly under Clinton, to some of the worst ethnic cleansing and atrocities of the mid-1990s, namely the huge repressive slaughter and destruction of Kurds in southeastern Turkey. I had a few sentences about it. Those few sentences were picked out by the public prosecutor and used as the basis for prosecution of the publisher. It's against the law to talk about these things in our democratic ally. He was facing a probably serious jail sentence. When I heard about it and was contacted by human rights activists here, who are incidentally extremely courageous people who very, very admirable, face serious dangers and threats all the time and do it quite consciously to try to challenge the laws and repression. They asked me if I could come to the trial, and I changed things around, canceled a couple of talks, and did come to the trial. The trial was yesterday morning, and everyone assumes because of the publicity that was given through international pressure, I guess the fact that I was here and so on, the indictment was dropped. Actually, I was technically a co-defendant. Under the laws, once I appeared, I was supposed to be charged alongside the publisher. The laws identify myself, but the prosecutor actually withdrew the charges, and the publisher was released. There was another associated event. As I say, these people here are extremely admirable. They decide, in protest against the laws, they published a collection of banned essays. That included mine, which had been banned, but also included, much more importantly, essays of people, some of whom were in fact in jail, writers, journalists, and others who told the truth about these matters. And it was co-published about a week ago. They asked me to sign as a co-publisher, and I did. And after the trial, we went to the prosecutor's office, essentially demanding to be charged under the laws, and that was also put off in a polite, pleasant way. I'd say it was a very pleasant conversation. In any event, that's at least delayed. I mean, you know, maybe when the international attention turns away, it'll continue. In fact, I have to say, right after the trial that I attended, there was another one in the same. These are state security courts. In the same state security court of a journalist who I met, who's on trial because of an interview that she conducted, in which whoever she interviewed said some things that are considered bad, banned, probably about Turkish repression of the Kurds. So the problem continues, but it's you have to really respect the people who are here, who are standing up constantly and challenging these repressive practices and making some inroads. I mean, the laws have been improved. The practices are still very harsh, but the laws have been improved, and it's chipping away at the repression. Actually, you know, we can't be very self-righteous about that. The same has been true in the United States. I mean, true freedom of expression in the United States was really only won, even formally, quite recently, in the 1960s, in the course of the civil rights movement. And, you know, obviously we don't face, have never faced anything like the repression of a country like this. So it's quite remarkable to see it firsthand, and it's really kind of like an honor to even be able to be a marginal part of it. And while I'm here, of course, I'm doing everything else, like giving talks to audiences and having interviews, meetings. Today I'm going off to Diyarbakir, which is the center of the Kurdish areas, the areas that have been under the most severe repression, and far worse than anything that was charged to Milosevic in Kosovo, for example. And at about the same time, except the only basic difference as far as we're concerned is that the United States is in it up to its neck. About 80% of the arms came from the Clinton administration. It's not pistols, that means jet planes, tanks, landmines, military training. And the flow of arms from the United States escalated as the ethnic cleansing and atrocities escalated. It's maybe made more grotesque by the fact that this was at exactly the time that Western intellectuals were lauding themselves to the skies about their magnificence and opposing the crimes of others. And this is right within NATO. It's not like across the borders from NATO. It took tremendous discipline for American media and intellectuals to suppress all of this at the very moment when they were engaged in the orgies of self-adulation for our humanitarian efforts and, against the crimes of others right nearby. In fact, astonishingly, Turkey is lauded not only in State Department reports, but even on the front pages of the newspapers for its having shown the way to eliminate terrorism, namely by massive state terror. that some of the worst atrocities of the 1990s. That's more or less the situation here, and it's an ongoing conflict involving very courageous, honorable people. That includes people like Turkey's most famous writer, likely Nobel Prize winner, Yasir Kemal, who was charged, in fact, for writing an article in which he described the Turkish activities in Kurdistan, Kurdish areas, as, well, in his words, the vilest war imaginable, which is correct. It's really quite horrible. Because of his international fame, he was tried and convicted, but the sentence was suspended. Others don't have the good fortune. Many of those who are protesting and, in fact, co-published the book are people who have been in jail. Some of them I happen to know personally, but one who was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. And they just continue. They continue very courageously, honorably, strongly. A lot of popular support, but by no means easy.
No. We're talking to Noam Chomsky. We're going to go back to that interview, speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey, where he stood with the publisher of a book of essays that included Noam Chomsky's own words. And for those words, the publisher was charged with publishing propaganda against the unity of the Turkish state. He was acquitted yesterday. At his side, Noam Chomsky. Stay with us.
I had a dream last night while I was lying on my bed. The whole world was standing still and the moon was turning red. I saw a sign in the sky. I have come to set you free. There's a light shining.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Fire and Brimstone. Neville Brothers is the music. As we continue with Resistance Radio, I'm Amy Goodman. The conversation I had with Noam Chomsky, 4 o'clock this morning, his time in Istanbul, Turkey, there for the trial of his publisher, Fatih Tas, who was just acquitted yesterday by the Turkish government for publishing propaganda against the unity of the Turkish state. I asked Noam Chomsky if he could explain the whole freedom of thought campaign, where thousands of Turkish citizens sign off as co-publishers of books to protect the actual publishers of books that the Turkish government considers seditious. Noam Chomsky continued.
Well, in protest, particularly against this trial of the publisher, a group of writers, journalists, academics, human rights activists, decided to put together a collection of writings. These are banned writings, writings which have already been banned by the courts, some of them written by writers who are in jail, in fact. Included in the banned writings happens to be the passages from my own article, which led to the trial. A group of them, a dozen or so, identified themselves as co-publishers of the book. They said, we're publishing this book. It's an act of civil disobedience, and it's an explicit violation of the draconian anti-free speech laws. They did ask me to list myself as a co-publisher. anyone who is a co-publisher is automatically subjected to to the legal processes of the state, which for a Turk could mean going to prison, which is not very much fun in Turkey or anywhere else, particularly here. As I'm sure you know, there are death fests going on of the Turkish political prisoners. Several of them have died, many of them will die in protest against prison conditions. But they purposely chose to present themselves to the public prosecutor as co-publishers of the banned book and to demand that they be tried for this crime in order to expose the nature of the laws. And in fact, yesterday after the trial, we did go to the public prosecutor's office to present this. This is not like the kind of civil disobedience that we do, you know, go out the streets, get arrested, put in jail for a night. This is far more serious. It's hard to express one's admiration for the people who are doing this.
Now, your publisher who got off on was ultimately exonerated by the court for publishing your book, has been in prison before, is that right?
He himself, he's a 23-year-old guy. I don't think he's been in prison yet. Maybe he has, but he's facing a series of other charges, I should say. And those are not going to be so easy to get out of, because in those cases, it's not going to be possible to find somebody from abroad who's pretty well known who will come and, you know, bring massive media attention internationally, not from the United States, but from Europe, and mainly from Europe and elsewhere. And that is protection, which most people don't get, and he won't get it either, unfortunately, for the other charges on which he's tried.
Has the Turkish government's desire to be a part of the European Union weighed into their decision not to imprison your publisher now?
I don't know if I can really say that, because, as I mentioned, it was right after, in the same state security court, there was a case immediately after this one of a journalist whose crime was publishing an interview. There's no international attention on that one, so nobody knows what will happen to her. Mm-hmm. However, yes, you're right. I mean, the pressure of the European Union has induced the government to liberalize the laws. They are better than they were. In fact, there are new laws now passed by Parliament. I don't think they've yet been fully ratified, which do improve the situation. You know, they don't make it perfect, but they improve it. And that's from European pressure. Unfortunately, you can't say the same about the United States. The United States has been pressuring the European Union to admit Turkey, irrespective of its human rights violations. And worse, these human rights violations, which are extreme, are highly praised in the United States. As I say, you can read front page articles on the New York Times praising Turkey for leading the way and showing how to deal with terrorism, which is kind of like articles praising Milosevic for showing how to deal with terrorism. So the role of our own role is by our, I mean me too, because we don't do enough about it, has been very ugly in this respect. And of course, what the United States does is of overwhelming significance. I mean, if any country, Turkey or, you know, Israel, Russia, whatever it is, if any country feels that they can get authorization from Washington, they're pretty well home free in this ugly world. So European pressures have been important and proper, but the United States has been standing in their way, and we should be concerned about that.
We're talking to Noam Chomsky. He's in Istanbul, having attended the trial of his publisher. Noam Chomsky's presence there probably is what got his publisher off for publishing a series of banned essays. In those essays, some of Noam Chomsky's own work, and now he heads to Kurdistan. Before we talk more about Kurdistan, I just wanted to ask you about Bush's so-called war on terrorism and the hailing of Turkey as a great ally in this.
Well, the war on terrorism, whatever you think about it, you know, you like it, hate it, whatever, it is certainly not a war on terrorism. I mean, just take a look at the people who are leading the war. I mean, the military component of the war is led by Donald Rumsfeld. The diplomatic component at the UN is led by John Negroponte. Well, who are they? Donald Rumsfeld was Ronald Reagan's special envoy to the Middle East. John Negroponte was ambassador, meaning proconsul, in Honduras under Reagan. There was a war on terrorism in the 1980s. The Reagan administration came into office declaring a war on terrorism. Know, plague spread by depraved opponents of civilization itself, and so on. And we know how they focused on two areas, the Middle East and Central America. And they fought that war by creating an international terrorist network of unprecedented scale, involving client states and mercenaries and so on, which led to massive destruction and terror, both in Central America and in the Middle East and indeed elsewhere. And the people who are in fact, they were even condemned by the World Court and the Security Council for it. You know, it's not controversial. And the people who ran those international terrorist networks in Central America and the Middle East, you know, implemented them. They're now the people who are running the war on terror. Well, you know, Orwell would be turning over in his grave looking at this. And it continues. I mean, I don't have to talk about it here. People know. So the fact is that the war on terror is being carried out with the same rhetoric and by the same people who, under the pretext of a war against terror, instituted and implemented massive terrorist activities. So we can be, and in fact, the people who are lining up in support of the war on terror are, for the most part, murderous terrorist states. Like Russia, happily joined the coalition against terror, and is being welcomed by the United States, precisely because they want U.S. authorization for their own brutal, monstrous terrorist activities in Chechnya. Say the same about China, and Turkey as well. Turkey was the first country to offer troops to fight the war against terror. And the Prime Minister Ecevit made it clear, stated, that he was joining the U.S. war on terror and providing troops in thanks to the United States for having been the only country that provided massive support for his own ethnic cleansing, atrocities, destruction, massacre in the 1990s. He didn't use those terms. I'm using those terms because they're the right one. That's the coalition. We can run through the list. I mean, that's the coalition against terror, and it's led by the one state in the world that happens to be condemned for international terrorism by the highest international authorities. So we can, you know, we can evaluate it as we please, but it's not a war on terror. Certainly not that. And anyone who even uses the phrase is demonstrating their subordination to state propaganda in a way which is so disgraceful it's hard to find the words for it. Now, there's a huge literature on the current war on terror, media, you know, journals, scholarly work. If you look at it, you discover a very striking feature. The U.S. The terror carried out by the United States and its clients is omitted. That's not discussed. In fact, that was also true of the massive literature on during the First War of Terror. Now, this is dishonesty of such an extreme nature that it's hard to find words for it. I mean, if we can't even rise to the minimal level of moral integrity, meaning if we apply standards to others, they apply them to us as well. If we can't even rise to that, then anyone who can't rise to that, you cannot even begin to take seriously anything they say about, you know, right and wrong, good and evil, terror, and so on. And that cuts a pretty broad swath. That, in fact, includes approximately 100% of the discussion on this. And the fact that this can continue is utterly shocking. I mean, if some outside observer were watching this, it would say some, you know, Martian scientist, they just would be speechless.
Noam Chomsky, as you travel through Turkey talking to people, what is their reaction to the U.S. bombing Afghanistan? And now it looks like very much planning to do the same in Iraq, although they have been bombing Iraq regularly for the last 10 years.
Well, you know, I'd hesitate to try to judge the atmosphere of a country by, you know, a couple of days of talks, guest talks to overflow audiences and so on, but you know, I wouldn't even talk about the atmosphere in the United States, which I know much better. It's much too complicated. But there's plenty of opposition. And in the case of Iraq, there's a lot of concern. There's a lot of concern for a very simple reason. They all know they're on the front line. There has been discussion here, as there has been in the United States to an extent, of the U.S. plans for an attack on Iraq. And it's pretty clear what they would be. The U.S. might attack Iraq because it meets the prime condition for an attack. It's totally defenseless, so therefore it can be attacked with impunity. That's a requirement. You don't attack anybody else. And furthermore, it's easy to mobilize opinion to support it because, in fact, Iraq happens to be directed by one of the world's major monsters, a major monster who the United States and Britain supported right through his worst atrocities. He was a favorite of George Bush the First, but that part can be excised from history very easily. And putting aside that fact, you can create the image, which happens to be correct, of a major monster and a danger. The major reasons for an attack on Iraq, if it takes place, are quite different. Iraq is has the second largest oil resources in the world outside of Saudi Arabia. The United States is not going to relinquish those. Furthermore, it is not going to relinquish those to its competitors and enemies. Right now, Russia and France in particular have kind of an inside track on developing Iraqi oil if it's opened up, and we can be pretty confident that the U.S. government's not going to permit that. So it's going to try to find a way to reincorporate Iraq within the U.S. orbit. Well, how could you do that? Well, you know, if you think it through, there's one way to do it, really. The U.S. can bomb from 20,000 feet, but it's not going to send ground troops to occupy the country. It's going to need ground troops. But who's going to provide them? Well, there's one country nearby that's a client state that happens to have, that's right, bordering Iraq, that happens to have large ground troops, major ground forces. In fact, it also provides the bases, the military bases in the southeast, right in the areas where the terrorism against the Kurds has been carried out, bases for U.S. Air Force and the Israeli Air Force, which fly there with probably nuclear-armed planes to bomb Iraq, to train for bombing Iran. And you know, general exercises in support of Turkey. Well, these are the ground forces that are very likely to be mobilized as a kind of a mercenary force to occupy northern Iraq. The Turks historically have felt, with some justice, that they were deprived of the oil of northern Iraq, which is very rich, by the British-French imperial settlement. And they have their eyes on it, so they'd like to get control of that oil. Well, you can imagine plans, which indeed have been described, they're discussed here, and they're described to an extent in the American press. in which the Turkish military forces would be used as a mercenary army to invade and occupy northern Iraq while the U.S. carries out, you know, long-distance bombing and destruction, and somehow gets control of southern Iraq. You know, the effects of... I don't doubt for a minute that people in the White House, you know, Wolfowitz, Pearl, others like that, are thinking about such options. And the Turks are well aware of it. In fact, they've been put under explicit pressure. It's discussed publicly in, by the Prime Minister, Parliament, press, and so on. The consequences of this, you know, quite apart from the morality of it, the consequences could be pretty awesome in the region and elsewhere. But it's a possibility that is not a remote contingency, and they're very much aware of it and very concerned about it. So that's an issue. It's a live issue.
In the last few days, we have played a documentary that focuses on Leyla Zana, the Kurdish parliamentarian in prison right now, I guess in her eighth year of a 15-year sentence for speaking Kurdish on the floor of parliament when she was being sworn in. You're going to Kurdistan. First of all, what obstacles do you face to go there? And explain what Kurdistan is. I mean, in Turkey, you can't call it that.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, the Kurds... Well, there are probably, you know, maybe 30 million of them or so around the area. They're scattered in several different countries. As a result of the imperial settlements, Kurds are all over the place. Turkey has, nobody counts, but it's probably on the order of maybe 12 to 15 million Kurds. They're mostly concentrated in the southeastern region. The way they're concentrated has been changed during the U.S.-backed atrocities of the 1990s, about 2 to 3 million of them were simply driven out. In the city that I'm going to, Diyarbakir, which is kind of the center of the Kurdish area, the population has increased by maybe a million. It's our crime, so nobody counts, really. But the estimates are it's increased by a million or more just from people driven in from the ethnic cleansing operations in the countryside, which destroyed about 3,500 towns and villages, burned down huge forest areas, and devastated a lot of the land. Very few of them have been able to go back. So the demographic effects have consequences changed in the last few years. That's what people, as you say, are not allowed to refer to as Kurdistan. In fact, even referring to the existence of the Kurds is problematic. For a long time, it was illegal. Now it's technically legal. But just 2 days ago, a Kurdish radio station was shut down in Diyarbakir for playing Kurdish music over the radio. That's not consistent with Turkish law, the new liberalized law. But as you know, there's a big difference between what's on paper and what's executed. So that's Kurdistan. Leyla Zana is a striking example. She was, during a period of liberalization, the Kurds were permitted to be elected to the parliament. She was elected, and when she gave her oath of office, or whatever you say, when you go in, she did it in Turkish, but then she added a statement in Kurdish saying that she was saying it in Turkish under duress. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that she wore Kurdish colors or something like that, which is banned. In fact, the day that I arrived in Turkey at the airport, the welcoming committee included two little girls who were dressed in Kurdish costume and Kurdish colors. And that caused a furor. Given the circumstances, they couldn't do much about it, but that's considered an utter outrage by nationalist, strongly nationalist Turks. You can't appear in Kurdish color. They weren't in a position with 1,000 journalists and photographers around to arrest two little girls, but it does take courage to do that. Leyla Zana is a case in point. She's been internationally awarded, but she's in jail. And I think, what is it, 8 years, something like that.
As you travel around, does Enron impinge on your consciousness at all, and all that it represents that has to do with international oil and gas, not to mention corporate corruption and U.S. government backing for it?
Yeah, I have to say, for the last 2 days, it hasn't been first in my attention. This was a fairly tense affair. Nobody knew what was going to happen yesterday. I mean, technically, I could be in jail, too. I presented myself as a defendant. And under Turkish law, they are actually required to pursue that. But no one expected them to. They didn't.
So why did you do it?
Why did I do it? I mean, for the same reason you would do it. You know, here's a... These are people who are... I mean, I happen to be personally involved, but it's a couple of sentences of mine that led to the trial. But now these are people who are... carrying out very courageous, honorable activities. They can survive only thanks to the attention that we managed to organize for them. I mean, they're not the only ones in the world, far from it. It's a case where we can do something.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time early this morning at about 4 o'clock to do this interview. How are you getting to Kurdistan?
Well, there was a question as to whether it would be... I actually, to tell you the honest truth, I don't want to talk too much. Everything is monitored.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll work out.
Well, go safely.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Democracy Now! That was Noam Chomsky speaking to us from Istanbul. We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now! This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on the theme of Turkey, before we move to our guest also in Istanbul, Sanar Yurdatapan, who is a Turkish human rights activist and musician, we are going to hear for a minute the words of Leyla Zana. Leyla Zana, who is the Kurdish parliamentarian who was sworn into parliament and wore, as Noam Chomsky was describing, the colors of the Kurdish flag in her hair when she went up to her swearing in, and then spoke some of her words at the end of her swearing in Kurdish. She said something along the lines of working for the Brotherhood of the Turkish and Kurdish people. But we're going to hear her do it. This is an excerpt that was just in a new film called The Back of the World, which was produced by Javier Corcuera. Let's listen to Leyla Zana herself as she was sworn in the Turkish parliament as a Kurdish parliamentarian. Put me. She's walking to the front. People are shouting those colors. She says, "I swear by my honor."
to protect the integrity and independence of the state, to protect the integrity and independence, the indivisible unity of people and homeland, and the unquestionable and unconciled sovereignty of the people. I swear loyalty to the Constitution. I take the path for the brotherhood between the Turkish people and the Kurdish people. People are shouting, "Deputy, deputy." This is Parliament Samanyol's, and what caused all that commotion? This is her husband speaking. She said, "I take this oath for the brotherhood between the Turkish people and the Kurdish people." Just a few words in Kurdish, and what a price. And then Leyla Zana went before the court, her accusers. In the video, we see the judge and the soldiers, the Turkish soldiers in the court, as Leyla Zana stood up and said, "This is a conspiracy. What I'm defending is perfectly clear. I don't accept any of these accusations, and if they were true, I'd assume responsibility for them, even if it cost me my life. I have defended democracy, human rights, and brotherhood between peoples. And I'll keep doing so as long as I live." That was Leyla Zana. She was sentenced to 15 years in prison. She has served 8 of those years. On the line with us, Sanar Yurdatapan, who is a Turkish human rights activist and musician, leader of the Freedom of Thought campaign in Turkey. He, too, has been arrested and jailed several times by the Turkish government on charges of supporting Kurds. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. As you listen to Leyla Zana, what are your thoughts as she remains in jail today?
Well, I've been in prison, in the same prison, in Ankara, and I had the chance to meet her a few times. Well, this is the reality in Turkey, unfortunately, because of the words she spoke, and they were very peaceful words, but only a few words in Kurdish. A provocation was prepared against her, and she's been imprisoned. It's a pity and a shame for my country.
Can you talk a little about the Freedom of Thought campaign? Noam Chomsky just spoke about it as well, but you are the leader of this campaign.
Yes, I'm a spokesperson of that initiative. It has started in 1995 when our famous writer, Yashar Kemal, his books are also translated into English and published in the USA, I believe, I know. He was invited to State Security Court to be questioned by the prosecutor about an article which was published in Der Spiegel, the German magazine, about Kurdish problem and the oppression of Turkish state on the Kurds. So that day, around over 90 intellectuals from many professions, we came together at the backyard of the State Security Court, and we started a signature campaign. It was a very simple text, not directly about Yashar Kemal, but we said, whoever has some trouble because of explaining his or her ideas, we will... no matter if we agree or disagree, we will put our signature on the same text so that they can either imprison all of us or none. The aim was to clear the main articles in Turkish legislation, at the minimum over 300 different articles, to clear them from Turkish legislation. Those articles define expression as a crime. And we first published a book, and in this book there were words from Yashar Kemal and also Leyla Zana and his friends and many others, 10 different articles. Over 1,000 people, 1,080 I think, were the collective publishers of this book. And this is the method we use. Article 162 of Turkish Penal Code says that republishing any article which is defined as a crime commits a new crime, and the publisher must be sentenced equally as the writer. And continues, it doesn't matter if he or she codes that he or she disagrees with the content, still responsible. So very good article. We use this. So when we published the book, a group of around 10 very, very famous artists, writers, trade unionists, journalists, we went to state prosecutor, gave the copy, and we said, please do your duty. Two cases were opened, and 185 well-known Turkish intellectuals were tried there. There was no result because in such cases, they usually make a little amendment of suspension, and they suspend all those sentences, thinking that they can get rid of us this way. But we went on publishing, republishing again and again, and from that day until now, we have published 1, 2, 3 books and 43 booklets. And the last one was on our 7th birthday anniversary, 23rd of January this year. And we published the last one. And in this last one, Chomsky's article was once more republished. And there were 11 articles to different things. And those 11 people whose articles were republished have been also the publishers of this book. It's called The Freedom of Thought 2001. And they went to prosecutor one by one, and so did Mr. Chomsky yesterday. After the trial of the first book, he left from backyard and went to the front door once again, went to state prosecutor, and with three of other so-called publishers, they gave petitions to force state prosecutor to open a new case against this book. And in this book, there are several different type of so-called crimes. Even, for example, a leftist or rightist or middleist, whatever it is, a religious one. Five of them are already in prison. Mr. Chomsky's article and the crime of the university students who gave petitions for education, partly education at least, in their mother language. So we'll see what's gone. It's a long story, excuse me, but I couldn't tell it shorter.
It's a very important story, and I thank you for sharing it with us. We've been speaking with Sanar Yurtapan, who is a Turkish human rights activist, leader of the Freedom of Thought campaign. As many as 70,000 so-called publishers sign on to some of the more controversial books that are published in Turkey to protect the actual publishers from the Turkish regime backed by the U.S. government. And that does it for today's program. As we speak of prisoners, I wanted to give a special shout out to one in this country. A special hello to Leonard Peltier, listening in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary in Kansas. And I'm headed out to Kansas City, Missouri tomorrow night and look forward to meeting listeners of KKFI. That's February 15th at 8 p.m. I'll be at All Souls Unitarian Church at 4501 Warwick in Kansas City, Missouri. For more information, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from downtown community television in Chinatown. Thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. Also thanks to Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV Channel, and public access TV stations and community radio stations around the country. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
But the lessons on being patient, be causing the pressure to rise, and makes up people suicidal. Oh no, another soul.